Looking to upgrade your bathroom without the hassle or the wait? Say hello to Blissful Baths, the stress-free way to transform your space into a relaxing retreat. Right now, Blissful Baths is offering 12 months with no payments and no interest. That's right, zero payments and zero interest for a whole year. Even better, they can replace your walk-in shower or bath in as little as one day. No mess, no long waits. Just a beautiful new bath space, fast. And here's the cherry on top. You can get up to 20% off with instant manufacturer rebates, plus extra savings for seniors and first responders. Ready to turn your bathroom into your own personal spa? Go to blissfulbaths.com today to request your free consultation. That's blissfulbaths.com. You deserve affordable luxury.
Hello and welcome back to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined by my co-host Chris Snowden. How are you doing, Chris?
Hi, Tom. Hi, listeners.
And we're delighted to be joined on the show today by Benedict Spence, political commentator known to many of our listeners, I'm sure. How are you doing, Benedict?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I'm very well. The Euros are here. How are you feeling about that, Chris? Is it coming home?
Well, I won some money on Scotland against Germany, so that was good. I broke my hoodoo. I had a recent hoodoo with gambling. I'm happy with the way it's going. Haven't seen as many games as I would have liked due to some of them being on in the afternoon. But I'm going to get more and more into it. I thought England played very badly against Serbia. But by the time this comes out, we'll have played badly against Denmark as well. So,
what about you, Ben?
Maybe not. I don't know.
It's funny enough. Actually, my gambling streak was going rather well until a few minutes ago. I was expecting Croatia to beat Albania, and Albania scored an equaliser in the 95th minute.
Did they?
Ooh. Yes, it was all going so well before then. But again, yeah, England not playing particularly well. Do we expect them to play particularly well? No. Gareth Southgate is the manager. We probably won't win. We'll probably go to the semi-finals. And that's just how my summer is going to pan out, I imagine.
But it feels like that. It feels like it's a bit of a win-win as far as people can feel vindicated about Southgate, even if we barrel out of the tournament, which is always...
We might have thrashed Denmark 9-0 by the time this comes out.
And look ridiculous.
Football fans can work out.
We'll still go out. We'll still go out in the semi-finals. It doesn't matter how much we...
Semi-finals?
Yes.
Oh, you're an optimist.
What was the last... we got to the... Was it semi-finals of the World Cup?
Yeah.
The one before that.
Yeah, well, that's the first time that's happened since 1990.
I think semi-finals is a reasonable assumption, simply because how many other teams are there that are demonstrably better than us? France, Germany, it's probably one more. That's four. That's semi-finals. So that's how my maths works, and this is how I've managed to luck my way to winning all these bets.
This is your theoretically, you're probably right, because we are probably in the top five or six in FIFA rankings, aren't we? Apparently Belgium's second in the FIFA rankings.
They've been not playing like it.
Terrible. Yeah. They got knocked out of the group stage last time. I had money on that as well, by the way. I had £100 on that. I didn't think they were going to win. I didn't think they were going to win the tournament, but I thought they were like 25-1 or something to win the tournament, and they were supposedly one of the best teams in the world. But I thought, well, they'll get out of this group stage because there's nothing, the minnows in the group stage, and I don't think they won a game. Mm-hmm. It was pathetic. Lukaku couldn't...
He's one of those players who always seems to score 30 goals a season, but whenever you watch him, he's got the first touch of a landmine.
Yeah.
You think, how on earth has this worked? You know,
he scored like 80-odd goals, apparently, for Belgium, but I've hardly ever seen him score one.
Yeah.
Had two disallowed. Anyway, we're getting a bit too much into the football, aren't
not
we?
Not at all. I mean, in the interest of crowbarring a sort of free speech-related topic, one of the controversies, Benedict, in recent days has been 10 German bombers, the beloved chant. There's always calls for English fans not to sing it. This time around, it came actually from the German police. I think there was a quote saying, "Don't be a dick. Don't sing German bombs.
Don't be dicks."
I mean,
what do you make of all of this?
The whole point of the song is to remind Germans not to be dicks. I thought that was that was the kind of big takeaway, is that, you know, historically speaking, their country does not have the best track record of not visiting. You know, it visits lots of destruction on European football teams, and before they really got into that, they did it across the continent on more than one occasion. So I think, given their reputation over the course of history, they could probably put up with a little bit of banter. You'd have thought that they might be able to put up with that. Apparently not, although I'm led to believe actually the average German fan does not take major offence at this, and they have their own songs for us because that's what football fans are like, and their
panto nationalism and all that.
It's completely fine. And I mean, you know, it doesn't break out into the sort of scenes you see, for instance, when Balkan teams play each other and they don't have funny songs for each other, or maybe they do, they just don't see the funny side. Or we saw the Turks and the Georgians the other day launching projectiles at each other. And you think, well, okay, a mean song, we've come a long way from the 80s. I think if that's sort of the height of rudeness, I think you can probably deal with that. And the German police have probably got bigger things to worry about given some of the other things that we've seen going on.
There's some fans singing this and walking around. There's one guy in a video who had actually a kind of an inflatable German bomber that he was carrying about, and people pretending to be shocked and outraged by this. Because I know we've talked previously on the podcast about this kind of
tragedy chanting.
The tragedy chanting thing. Yeah. I don't think anyone could call shooting down the Luftwaffe tragedy, really, in the grand scheme of things.
Many people
a defensive
are
operation, you know.
Who's being offended by this? Like some aged Luftwaffe pilot or something. It was a very long time ago. And I don't think anyone, England fan or otherwise, has any particular animosity to the Germans anymore. You know, my grandparents' generation didn't like them, generally speaking, or the Japanese for quite understandable reasons. Such a long time ago, it's just a bit of fun now. And this song, it annoys me a bit that it's not sung to the tune of 10 Green Bottles, I'd say. It's a little bit confusing, this.
So you've got a kind of musical objection to it.
Around the mountain, yeah.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I can see why they like it, because it goes on a long time. So it does give you something to do while you're waiting for the game to start. Or waiting on a train station, as apparently a lot of England fans were the other night. I think the Germans need to get a sense of humour. In general, and about this specifically, because the guy was saying, the chief of police, he was saying that the it's not actually illegal to do this. He sounded a bit disappointed that it's not illegal to sing derogatory songs about the Luftwaffe. But he did say it's illegal to do a Heil Hitler salute, so we'll get you for that. But with the rest of it, the reason he was saying don't be dicks, had to kind of plead with the England fans rather than just threaten them. He was going like, Viva l'Italia! If you start doing the Hitler salute, but we unfortunately cannot do anything about this. Not against our laws, but please don't be dicks.
And we should say it's not just... picturing it now. It's not.
Can you do that in Germany? Can you do an impression of a German? I was going to say yes. The long,
sort of hate crime,
long list
surely.
Of things that the Germans have banned, and they think, didn't think of this before. We're going to have to pass a law, but it'll be too late by then. I'm very upset about this.
It's just not an offensive chant by any football standards, really.
We can think of some.
There's lots of offensive chants.
Please send them in.
We discussed some of them before. But that one really is at the very soft end of it.
It's like the moral panic about football fans, thuggery, general loutishness seems to persist even in the absence of any of that behaviour. Like, that anything genuinely offensive or too kind of hooliganesque has been pretty much pushed to the margins at this point.
We have to remember, by the time this comes out, we may have destroyed some jokes.
But again, I mean, at its core, it's a chant about economic output coupled with poor political decisions, because the song actually goes very quickly. You're saying it doesn't matter how wonderful your economy is at churning these things out. If you make bad political decisions, well, you won't have any of the benefits of this. Doesn't matter how many planes you make. Actually, you can get rid of them at quite a good rate of knots. And given what's been going on with German military procurement and their reticence, if you like, or heel dragging on sending weapons to the Ukrainians, I'd have thought there are actual practical lessons for this.
So learning possibility.
Yes, this is how I'm going to defend the behaviour of England fans. Is that actually they're making a geopolitical point, and really the Germans ought to pay more attention to this sort of thing.
Well,
because
apparently,
Putin would like you to ban it. So.
Apparently, it has been adapted for a Ukrainian audience.
Oh, has it really?
With an anti-Russian slant. I broke my golden rule and did a tiny bit of research for this by looking at the Wikipedia page for this particular song. And I discovered that. But I also discovered, according to Wikipedia, so take it with a pinch of salt, that it's actually originally just a children's song that's been adopted by England fans. I don't know if that's true or not, but that would imply that kids were singing it in the 40s, right? That'd be pretty cool if that's what they were doing. Write in, lastorders@spike. Dot on
we need the full history of this.
If you know whether 10 German Bombers was originally a children's song.
So we talked about how confident or lacking in confidence we were with the England team, but I suppose one thing that's probably hanging over this Euros, because of the last Euros and the big kind of panic about fans' racism and so on, there was almost an attempt to get that going in earnest in the friendly against Iceland, where I think Saka came on for about 20 minutes, but he was the one who was chosen for his photo on the back pages, and that was kind of presented as, oh, the black players are being scapegoated and so on. But do we reckon there's any chance of that coming back into the mix? The kind of idea that England fans all just hate their players when they don't resemble them exactly.
I mean, Jude Bellingham is the poster boy for this England team, so it's very difficult, I think, to make that argument. I mean, you know, if a player does well, actually, they'll pin him up. And right now, actually, it's not Saka that they're talking about. It's Phil Foden, rightly, because he's not playing very well. So I think that's
he's out of position, to be fair.
Yeah, it's very easy when you're playing in a team that's, you know, cost over £1 billion to assemble to have a perfect position. You can be rested and rotated. I don't think he's that good in the grand scheme of things. I don't think he's as good as Jude Bellingham. I think he's a very good backup. There, that's a controversial take for player of the year, multiple Premier League, Champions League winner. Not that good.
We're getting a bit more onto the
we are, but I mean, when it comes to the criticism of England players, I mean, look, if you've got players who are pushed as players like Bukayo Saka are because they represent certain things, be it because people like the idea of multicultural Britain or because he's a well-behaved guy who, you know, went to school, didn't sort of...
Goes to church on Sundays.
There's no sort of, you know, negative backstory, and he's a very good footballer. Well, when he doesn't play and he's in the spotlight or he doesn't play well, that is obviously going to be the thing that people focus on. And, you know, we'd love it if there were other players for us to lambast. And I'm sure before the end of this tournament, there will be plenty of other players for us to lambast of all different backgrounds. But it's just how football is. You know, you absolutely slaughter a fantastically talented person for one, you know, 22-year-old for one bad game. That's how it goes. That's what you paid the big money for.
And it is worth reminding people that that moral panic about fans' racism in 2021 at the Euros was genuinely a moral panic. It was based on almost nothing. Yeah. I mean, you had those three black England players missed their penalties. There was all of this trolling which happened on social media, which a later BBC investigation found predominantly came from abroad. It was like Saudi teenagers and things who were sending these horrendous sort of
with like three
messages.
Followers.
And then the other things, remember the Marcus Rashford mural that was defaced and it was presented as, oh God, this is obviously part of the same thing. The graffiti on the mural was kind of even blurred out in the media coverage. Because it was just a cock and balls and like shite in a bucket. And also it was in Manchester City blue, which would probably indicate what the real motivation for it was. So it is worth reminding people that despite the fact that narrative has been pretty set now, it was complete nonsense.
It's been pushed though, because that was in the aftermath of George Floyd and you know, racism was everywhere. And that was the big talking point because, of course, he had the taking of the knee and that was controversial. Why are England players taking the knee at the Euros when this has got nothing to do with them? You know, not to reopen that, but it was a very febrile atmosphere because people wanted to talk about race relations. That was the sort of big conversation of the day because nobody wanted to talk about COVID. Everybody wanted to forget about that rather awkward period of time when everybody had been locked up. So that, then it sort of, you know, took on a life of its own. I think people really are sort of scraping the barrel, though. They tried to make that, you know, a thing again. Nobody's buying it anymore. Mm-hmm. We've moved on. And as I say, the fact that Jude Bellingham is on every TV advert, every front page, and he is the one that's sort of leading the team, you can't really make the case that there is this great sort of racist undercurrent, you know, underpinning the England national team's fans, if that's your literal go-to guy.
Looking to upgrade your bathroom without the hassle or the wait? Say hello to Blissful Baths, the stress-free way to transform your space into a relaxing retreat. Right now, Blissful Baths is offering 12 months with no payments and no interest. That's right, zero payments and zero interest for a whole year. Even better, they can replace your walk-in shower or bath in as little as one day. No mess, no long waits, just a beautiful new bath space, fast. And here's the cherry on top. You can get up to 20% off with instant manufacturer rebates, plus extra savings for seniors and first responders. Ready to turn your bathroom into your own personal spa? Go to blissfulbaths.com today to request your free consultation. That's blissfulbaths.com. You deserve affordable luxury.
Talking about scraping the barrel, Chris, should we talk about the WHO's latest reports? I know you've written a piece about it. They're seemingly taking aim at all kinds of vices, all kinds of companies, suggesting that they're all making us ill and so on. Do you want to tell us a little bit about this particular bit of research, in inverted commas?
Yeah, so this is a report that came out last Wednesday with an official WHO Europe report. Heavily press released, heavily covered in the media. The big thing the media picked up on was the claim that four industries are responsible for 2.7 million deaths a year in Europe. Those industries are fossil fuels, really more than one industry, to be honest. But anyway, fossil fuels.
Clues in the name, yeah.
Alcohol, tobacco, and ultra-processed, inevitably ultra-processed food, which again is more than one product, more than one industry. Well, maybe one industry. Anyway, they started off by saying products, but then the press release said industries, which is very telling because what they really were trying to get at was essentially capitalism, free market, and profit-making businesses, which is made very explicitly in this very lengthy report. The report itself, to Britain's shame, is written mostly by boneheaded UK public health academics, some of whom have been banging this drum for at least a decade. And it's just very worrying, I think, that WHO is officially endorsing them and their cranky, hard-left position on these issues. Because I'm one of the few people familiar with their work at all. And I only follow it out of morbid curiosity and wanting to sort of laugh at them because their basic premise is that Well, 10 years ago, they said, we've identified all these tobacco industry strategies, right, in public affairs and policy making. And the tobacco industry do the following six things. And it's stuff like lobbying the government and threatening legal action and building coalitions.
Because no other corporation,
no other corporation or indeed civil society organization, when engaging in political activity, would think about lobbying a politician or building a coalition. Yeah, it's very, very underhand behavior, isn't it? So they said, these are the big tobacco strategies, and this is why they need to be excluded from policymaking. And they literally are now, thanks to a WHO treaty. And then they said, actually, we've looked at the sugar industry and the dairy industry and the alcohol industry and the gambling industry, and they do most, if not all, of these things too. And of course, this is an incredibly banal thing to say, because public health people do all the same things. I've gone through them one by one. Public health people do exactly what they're accusing big tobacco and big sugar and big food and big everybody else of doing. And in this WHO report, anyhow, they take this together and they say it again, and they say all these industry strategies. Actually, we've looked at other corporations, and basically all the corporations do this. So all the corporations are bad for your health in one way or another, whether it's the gig economy or not paying people as much as we would like them paid. So the whole of capitalism is bad for your health, and these guys should not be allowed in the policymaking process at all. So that would mean pharmaceutical industry can't speak to government. It would mean the fossil fuel industry can't speak to government. Well, to take a couple of examples by David Zarek, who writes about these things very well. Imagine during the pandemic if the government couldn't speak to the pharmaceutical industry. Imagine during the energy crisis if governments couldn't speak to the fossil fuel industry. It's absurd. Mm. And someone at the WHO should have seen that it's absurd and academically worthless. And he's going to make them look ridiculous. But they didn't. They endorsed it. They had a big launch, and one of their top men said, this is very worrying research here, very worrying, and we need to do something more about corporations.
It's incredible. What do you make of all this, Benedict? WHO, we're supposed to handle the big things, pandemics and so on. We all know how that went for them. And yet they seem obsessed with not just lifestyle issues, but corporate capitalism in general.
Right? That is ultimately what it all boils down to, is that all of your problems can be solved if only you were to get rid of this thing called capitalism, which is literally killing you. And there's this other thing called democracy, which sometimes informs capitalism. And we're not too particularly keen on that, but we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. It's that's ultimately what it is, though. If you remove the mechanisms by which any industry outside the remit of government can operate or interact with government, well, by necessity, government will take a far greater interest in all senses of that word in the running of that industry. And, well, that's how oligarchies effectively start. That's how we move from a system of democracy to simply pure bureaucracy manifesting itself, you know, hiding behind the illusion of democracy and going, oh, no, it's completely fine. Everybody has freedom of expression, freedom of choice and all these things. But actually, that's not how these things work at all. And you can already see that reflected in the way that certain political trends are going in this country, for example. You know, the refrain, the Conservatives and the Labour Party, there's nothing between the two. They don't offer you anything differently. Well, that is ultimately because the state is simply co-opting everything. And even when a party gets into government, it doesn't matter what they promise you. Actually, they find it incredibly difficult to change anything because the rules are already set and you can't change the rules. The lawyers say you can't change the rules. So if you get a supranational body like the WHO saying, well, you've got to take away this power and this freedom and this, that and the other, and all the various states agree and they go, yes, that's absolutely right, well, then there's even less opportunity for there to be any form of changes. More centralization of power within the bureaucracy, even less opportunity to challenge it. Which is ultimately how you get people reacting at a political level, going to the the hard right or the extremist or even the hard left parties because they're frustrated and they recognize, even if they're not necessarily able to articulate it, they recognize that things aren't changing, that things are becoming more centralized. And with that, they become more stolid. As you say, actually, change at any kind of pace becomes incredibly difficult. And as we saw during the pandemic, in the case of emergencies, which do happen, I know we're supposed to think that history just ended and that everything's going to be perfect and stationary forever. But when things change, when there's a war, when there's a pandemic, when there's a shortage, I know when power plants blow up or whatever, you do need people to react very quickly. What is the thing you notice actually about increasingly Western societies? They are incapable of reacting particularly quickly in the way that actually private companies are often a lot better able to adapt, no matter how large they are. The slow grinding to a halt, if you like, of progress. And it is when, as has been alluded to, when people point to the major engine of human progress, which has been capitalism, whether you like it or not, and go, that is the problem. And then afterwards, the end result is, well, nothing's actually improving. You think, well, I wonder why that might be, because we got rid of the major engine of progress.
I am always struck by, whether it's the public health lobby or it's the environmentalists, they tend to only really criticise the things about capitalism that are the good things about capitalism, like the fact that it can produce all of this food, the fact that it can produce plentiful energy. Mm. That's the bad thing about it rather than anything else. But Chris, we've talked a lot about WHO throughout the COVID years and so on. Basically, the sort of mask was pulled off it. The idea that it was, in a sense, an effective institution was completely robbed of it. The idea that it would actually be a useful kind of coming together for states to talk about how to respond, it was just kind of haplessly repeating the line from the CCP and so on. Do you detect there's been any reckoning with the WHO's dealing with the pandemic, or is its reversion back to talking about lifestyle stuff and corporations show that that's not the case?
Very obviously the latter, isn't it, Tom? There hasn't been any...
There's been no debate about it at all. Not really, no. Not that it would be a hot topic necessarily, but it's still striking that there's been no even attempt to ask what went wrong, you know.
There's been no sense of contrition from the WHO either. If anything, they've just marched on at twice the speed as before, you know. Tedros could have resigned, for example. He's been in the job for quite a while. He wouldn't have to say, look, I balls this up. He could have just gone and been replaced by somebody else and they could have tried to, you know, revive their image. But they haven't. They've gone right back to going on about vaping. I don't know if you've seen any of seen their tweets about vaping. Every single one of them gets a community note within about 6 hours. Because they keep saying, look, it's a vape. It's designed by the tobacco and it should kill you. And then you just get this community note with about 100 references saying they weren't. The one you're showing isn't made by the tobacco industry. They don't kill you and they wouldn't be designed to kill you even if they did. They're doubling down, you know. And I'm not some fire-breathing populist who wants to withdraw from the world and have the country become a pariah. But if you look at the state of the WHO and a lot of the UN institutions, it's very hard to see how they're going to be repaired. You have the Secretary General of the United Nations, not some little, you know, underling, but the actual guy who runs it, only a few weeks ago, making a big speech about how we need to ban adverts for fossil fuels. Well, firstly, how many adverts for fossil fuels do you see? I'm not quite sure what that means. I guess it might include things like cars and stuff like that, and aeroplanes, I guess, rather than all the adverts for coal we keep seeing. You know, the coal market.
Do you ever see the advert for Shell and goes, yes, I'm going to change my oil provider?
But, you know, the fact that the Secretary General of the United Nations, A, thinks that this is a sensible thing that might have any kind of effect on global energy demand, and B, you know, thinks that this is a fitting thing for the United Nations to be talking about. It's pathetic. It's the kind of thing you'd expect from a student union. You get all these bloody UN special rapporteurs every now and again turn up in Britain saying, oh, poverty in England is worse than it is in Sudan. And the Guardian takes them seriously. Everyone goes, why is the poverty guy coming to England talking? It's just completely been hollowed out by idiots who believe stupid things from the worst universities. I don't think it's going to be repaired.
And you see how trivial these organisations have become by how, when the shit hits the fan, they are just kind of cast to one side. I mean, during COVID, it's not as if everyone kind of assembled at the World Health Organization. Nation states took control because they had legitimacy to do so. Same happened in the European Union. You know, suddenly the borders were re-erected because of the fact that at the end of the day, politicians are accountable to their own electorates and they're going to develop their own programs and so
what's
on.
What's the UN doing in Ukraine? Really, and what they're doing to help or hinder or bring peace or anything. They're not, they're talking about
banning resolutions and things,
natural gas adverts and stuff.
It is that sort of that issue, isn't it? That when there is an actual catastrophe, when there's an actual disaster, you sort of see how things are supposed to snap into action, things are supposed to change. But even COVID wasn't really the disaster that a lot of people were anticipating. People thought it was going to be the Black Death, and it wasn't. So, you know, I think that there has been an ability to sort of move on in a way and almost just sort of ignore it because, oh, okay, it was only, you know, a couple of million people relative to what we thought, which was that the world could potentially collapse. If you were to find yourself, I mean, let's take the war in Ukraine, which is actually quite a limited war, but has had huge impacts on global supply chains, energy prices, all that sort of thing. Let's say that we were going to replicate that in Taiwan, for instance, and the knock-on effects of that. Would it be possible for these organizations to sort of continue, not even afterwards, but, you know, in the short term, would they be able to continue spouting on all of this stuff when suddenly getting as many calories into you or having them readily to hand suddenly becomes an incredibly important thing? Having stress relief, you know, actual ways of blowing off steam, you know, ways of giving yourself an energy boost, things like nicotine actually become quite useful things to have to hand out to troops, if nothing else. You know, how is it that you're able to then spin that? And it's then, I suppose, the scale of destruction that is caused by an actual catastrophic event. How does an organization like the WHO survive long term when people go through a protracted period of time where their lives are completely uprooted and then are expected to go back to normal? COVID, relatively a bit of a flash in the pan, and lots of people recognize the rules that were put in place for being relatively quite ridiculous because actually it was an overreaction. But, you know, is anybody actually going to buy the idea that fossil fuels are bad if suddenly, you know, there's a major sort of energy crisis or Russia ends up being, you know, going to war with the United mm-hmm. States and there's actual sort of energy embargoes? Or heaven forbid, let's say Iran gets a nuclear weapon and then suddenly Saudi Arabia decides it's going to ramp up its own production and then suddenly things begin to kick off there. Let's say we have an actual crisis. Does any of this stand up to reason? No. At that point, all countries sort of rush to their own defenses to look after themselves. Mm. And it does then make you just sort of wonder, so what on earth were we doing in peacetime? Like allowing this sort of thing to
And they have been at this kind of thing for years. I think, was it during the Ebola pandemic that Tedros's predecessor was at a vaping conference in Russia or something?
Anti-vaping conference in Moscow.
This is absurd. And that was...
Yeah, but no one's ever going to do anything about it. I think that you make a very good point there, Ben. Countries will end up just doing what they need to do in the moment and push these organisations to the side, but they won't actually abolish them because they're just sort of kind of irrelevant and people can just accept, well, the UN's a waste of space and so is the WHO.
But it is...
Let them carry on.
It is also a useful weapon with which to cudgel countries that are incredibly credulous.
Yes.
China, for instance, I don't think cares about environmentalism given its energy policy. It does what's best for the Chinese economy. But if it can use something like the UN or the WHO to batter very credulous Western audiences into doing things that are a self-harming thing, well, it's absolutely going to support those organizations to that end. But again, we see this even within Europe when it comes to things like the ECHR, when we're always told that, you know, Britain can't do X, Y, Z, oh, because it'll violate international law. Does Italy listen to that? Does Greece? No. They weigh up the pros and cons and they go, oh, well, we might, you know, get a bit of a slap on the wrist, but this is a much more cost-effective thing to do, even if it does break international law, and we're just going to do it and then say, haha, sorry, we shouldn't have done that and we won't do it again, promise. It just seems to be a real small niche, small concentration, rather, of countries, of which we seem to be one for some unknown reason. We are absolutely determined to be one of these who buy these sorts of lines, hook, line, and sinker, and are then left sort of scrabbling when everybody else who has been ignoring these things in the first place has an advantage over us.
Yeah. Well, we try to obey the law in this country, which is, generally speaking, been a good thing for us when we had not that many laws and most of which were quite good. It doesn't work quite so well when you start getting involved with the EU and if international law. We have millions of laws and they're terrible, whereas the Italians are used to having lots of stupid rules.
Should we talk about drink driving?
Oh, yeah.
This is also another story you picked out. So they're going to lower the level.
The British Medical Association want the government.
They want them to lower the level. Do you want to tell us a bit more about this, Chris?
It's kind of one of the things where, in a way, it's surprising that some nanny state government hasn't done it yet, given that nearly the whole of Europe has a lower drink driving limit than we do. So ours is, let me get this right, 80 milligrams of alcohol per 100 milliliters of blood. And around Europe, it's most commonly 50 milligrams. To put that in terms that the average drinker can understand, depends a lot on how big you are, whether you're a man or a woman, how quickly you drink it and so on. But as a rule of thumb, you're okay drinking a pint and a half of beer in this country, especially if you're a man. And if it dropped it to 50, it would be touch and go whether one pint would be too much. So it makes a bit of a difference. This is not the hill I'm going to die on, to be perfectly honest with you, what the exact drink driving limit should be. I certainly don't think it should be zero, which it is in some countries, because that acts essentially as just a way of stopping you drinking the night before. It's a temperance policy, basically. However, I'm quite happy with it being where it is. I think it's actually comes down to simply a question of evidence. You can look at this empirically and see whether it makes any difference dropping the limit to 50 milligrams, because that's exactly what Scotland did 10 years ago. There have been three quite good peer-reviewed studies, two by economists, two by public health people even, in The Lancet, in the latter case, all of which found that the change in Scotland made absolutely no difference to the number of collisions, number of fatalities, number of accidents, you know, big accidents, small accidents, didn't do anything except reduced the amount of alcohol sold in pubs a bit, which was compensated for by an increase in the amount of alcohol sold in off licenses. But the gist seems to be that people did indeed change their behaviour in Scotland, hence the decline in pub sales. And also the fact that convictions didn't go up. If people hadn't changed to abide by the new law, you would expect to see an increase in convictions. So we know that Scots did obey the law, and we know that it didn't make any difference to traffic accidents. And it's pretty easy to work out why that is. You know, we used to call it drunk driving, right? And somewhere along the line, it became drink driving, which still most countries, I think, still call it drunk driving. But we call it drink driving, which then allows you to say, well, any amount of alcohol is bad and what have you. It's just not. I mean, the whole point of having laws against drunk driving is to stop people who are drunk from driving because they're not capable of driving a car. But you are capable of driving a car after a pint. It makes really no difference to you. You might as well ban people from driving when they've not had 8 hours sleep or something. You know, there's all sorts of things that might have a tiny effect on the margins.
10 cups of coffee in a row or something.
Right, yeah. Or indeed, you know, before you're 25 years old or after the age of 75 or what have you. And I know, actually, that there was a bill going through Parliament to prevent 25-year-olds from driving in various circumstances, but that's beside the point. Perhaps that's where this slippery slope goes. I think we can defend the current limit purely on empirical grounds. Britain does not have a particularly high rate of drink driving, quite low, actually. Roads are safer than most countries, and they're as equally as safe as Scotland when you adjust for all the relevant factors. So it's a waste of time, and it's interesting that the BMA are campaigning for this because they should know the evidence. Mm-hmm. Same thing applies to, you know, people saying we should ban fast food shops, the recent one being Newcastle. Yes. There's just no evidence for it. There's just no good evidence suggesting that people who live near fast food shops are any fatter than anybody else. The takeaways, for a start off, they deliver. Don't need to live near them, for God's sake.
I mean, I've always been very sceptical about the sort of the general demonization of alcohol, given that Western civilization is based on the activities of people who did nothing but drink alcohol because the water wasn't safe. You know, it's
you can still get a lot done.
You can, ultimately. I think that that's the thing, is the difference between drunk and having had a drink. Actually, a lot of people find they're sort of, they can work in much better circumstances. They can be more creative in many ways. They can be more focused if they've had a very small amount of alcohol. Now, that is not to say try it whilst you're going for a drive, but it doesn't actually necessarily impact everybody the same way. And I think that's, if nothing else, the fact that if you're having a drink and a half and you know that there is a drinking limit is probably more likely to make you a little bit more cautious when you drive, because you think, hang on, I've had a drink, I need to behave. Just to sort of take the step back, yes, Chris is right, nobody's actually going to sort of die on the hill of saying we bring back drinking in the quantities that we used to because everything was fine and, you know, what's a few traffic collisions between friends. But it's one of those things where you sort of look at the general state of politics in this country at the moment and you think, right, plenty of criticisms of the Labour Party, of its manifesto, of what it is trying to do, what it's not trying to do. A lot of people saying that it's not particularly ambitious, it's not particularly bold, right? So it needs to have some things. There need to be things that both political parties need to be saying to people to say, look, things need to be done and we're getting things done, which is unlike the, I can't remember the name of the MP it was that raised the prospect of banning the under 25s from driving at certain times of night, because that's not going to make a huge difference. But that did strike me as one of those sort of, well, we need to be seen to be making your lives better, to be thinking safety first. And of course, it's about young
Michael
people.
Michael Gove style policy. I don't think it actually was him, but it might as well.
Yeah. No, I can't.
He's probably looking at it, admiring it.
Just thinking, I'm leaving Parliament at just the wrong time. There are so many policies I could vote for. And therein, I think, lies so many of the problems with our politics at the moment, is that in lieu of the ability to change or the vision to change the major structural issues that the country faces, you will see lots of sort of tinkering around the edges of policies that actually will make next to no difference anyway, but will make people feel good. Mm-hmm. And actually, you know, the average voter, it will probably look at and go, yes, alcohol and driving, not good. You know, let's bring them down. Fantastic. Good policy. Without necessarily thinking it's going to impact them at all, because they don't consider themselves a dangerous driver at all. So they'll be thinking, it's a net good, because the average member of the public is not going to dive down into the data and go, well, hang on, how much has this affected things elsewhere? So it dispirits me that we're at this stage now in this country's sort of political life where that is kind of what we're doing. We're thinking, what are these things that can make politicians feel good about themselves, you know, plaster it on leaflets and stuff and say, not only have I stopped any houses being built near you or any new water reservoirs, on top of that, it's even harder for there to be drunk drivers because we've reduced it by a third.
And we ban the possession of dog meat.
Absolutely. A license.
And you won't find a KFC within miles of this particular place.
You've got a license for that vape. That's so cool. That's the direction we're heading in. Switzerland, but without any of the wealth. Or the mountains. So, you know, lots to look forward to. It's going to be a fun 5 years. Honestly, though, that's the word. Dispiriting. There's nothing to look forward to apart from more and more joy being taken out of your life and your taxes creeping up.
It is going to make them look even more trivial, you know. Labour coming in, very short honeymoon, as you said, and all they have to point to is the fact that they've, you know, gone to war with the chicken shops or followed through on Sunak smoking ban or whatever. We're almost out of time, but Benedict, we always ask our guests one final question, because we're a quite libertarian, anti-ban kind of podcast. We invite our guests to, if they had to pick one ban, sort of dictator for the day, what would it be? The only caveats or conditions are that you can't pick something that's particularly worthy. You can't ban world hunger or whatever. It's got to be something quite petty.
Which I wouldn't do anyway.
It hasn't come up yet. Petty, authoritarian, wheelie suitcases is Chris's, to give you an example.
There's a similarity there. It's a sort of a very slow-moving vehicle.
Luggage-based.
It is young mothers walking two abreast with prams.
Yeah.
All going in the same direction. I don't know why they need to go forward in battle formation going down a street so that everybody else has to get out of the way or stop.
With double prams, you're
talking. Yeah.
Yeah. And usually only with one baby in it. And sometimes no babies in it.
Are you saying two mothers with two prams?
Well, no, this is the thing. If there's one, it'll be one. They'll be in the middle. If there's two, they'll still be sort of going at exactly the same pace next to each other. The other thing that they do that I have observed often enough for it to obviously be a pattern, they walk into the middle of the road without looking and they push the pram forward because they assume that people will stop because they see the pram. And you just think,
really?
That's not a smart thing to do. I've seen it enough times to think that's a phenomenon, that that's not just one person being, you know, unaware of their surroundings.
Are we sure there's a baby in that pram?
Well, this is the thing. And perhaps as a little caveat, far too many people with prams with dogs in them. I would also ban that.
Yeah,
that's just prams. I'll just get rid of prams.
Also, the size of the prams. Yes. When did they get this big? It's like the Victorian era or something. Like, you know, what happened to those horrible plastic foldy things that we used to be pushed around in? And now they're enormous, like 4x4s or something.
This is the Americanization of the vehicle market in general, is that, you know, sort of 4x4s get bigger and American cars get bigger. Everything else has to get bigger. Your fridge gets bigger. Your pram has to get bigger. It needs, you know, reinforcement because, presumably, they push their prams into the middle of the road. So it needs thicker rubber.
Those cars would bounce off them.
Absolutely. But that would be the thing that I would ban. Yes, let's just reduce it down. Prams. Carry your child. make it walk.
Yes. Well said. Anything that gets in my way when I'm walking, I will ban. I've got some wheeled suitcase news, actually.
Oh, yes, Tom, please.
I just want to mention a big shout-out to The Lady Magazine, who, in, I think, the current issue, ran a debate. are wheeled suitcases a good thing? They are universally popular but can have disadvantages, it says at the top, rather slanting the debate towards the suitcase.
I know it's The Lady Magazine, but it's a shame they didn't invite you to make your
case. I would have been happy to do it. This is between Liz Hodgkinson, who I think is a freelance journalist. She's saying no, quite rightly. And she makes some very good points. And then we've got Gillian Spicanell, who I think is the PA to the editor, who I guess is Rachel Johnson, I think, isn't it, the lady? Used to be, anyway.
Don't read as much as I used to.
She talks a lot of nonsense about how they're a good thing, but of course they're not. I noticed that this seems to be a regular feature of The Lady Magazine. They have the same two people debating.
Oh, okay. So it's not...
Every month.
They're the only two people in the office.
They really disagree about everything. So previous debates include, does Christmas start too early? Liz Hodgkinson says yes, but Gillian Spicanell argues no. What are your thoughts? Have single-sex schools had their day? And my personal favourite, should women's clothes have pockets?
I'm starting to think that if they're always the two debating, that maybe they don't actually have that.
Maybe you think it's contrived? You think they don't actually care that much?
I fear that might be the case.
Well, I think you should have them both on.
Yeah.
Actually go through all of these and say, so what do you think?
Yeah, Gillian, if you want to come on and defend your ridiculous views in The Lady Magazine, I will happily debate you. Or Liz, if you want to come on, well said. Thank you. Be a pleasure.
Open invitation. Last orders at spike-online.com.
I want to discuss whether women's clothes should have pockets. I want to know what the anti-position is.
On that note, Ben, Chris, thank you very much. You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.